content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ann Jordan for the North Carolina Reading Service, and welcome to Oprah Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah.com. All right, this first article is called "This Nonprofit Sends Free Pizza to Voters Stuck in Long Lines Nationwide. Pizza to the Polls is Fueling Democracy, One Slice at a Time." The photo shows a box of pizza. It looks like it has tomatoes, cheese, and I'm not sure what else. All right, it says, picture it. You slip away from your office or work from home setup at lunchtime during early voting or on election day to cast your ballot. But the line at your polling site is out the door and down the block. An hour later, you're hungry and thinking of giving up. Don't. Instead of bailing on your civic duty, you can contact Pizza to the Polls, a nonprofit that sends free hot pies to crowded voting stations. The nonpartisan organization started providing tasty reinforcements in the days before the November 2016 election, when three co-workers in Oregon grew alarmed by reports of 3 and 4 hour waits at early voting sites in other states. In Cincinnati, one line stretched half a mile. We knew we couldn't make the process move faster, but we could help people keep from leaving, says co-founder Katie Harlow. We thought, what is something that people really like? Free food. A few hours later, the trio had a name, a Twitter handle, a website, and a plan. To report long lines, voters submit a social media post documenting the crowd size to the nonprofit's website. Pizza to the Polls then uses the money donated by fellow citizens to have pies delivered from a local pizzeria. To date, the group has sent more than 16,500 pepperoni, cheese, veggie, barbecue, and Hawaiian pizzas to the voting sites in 41 states from New York to California and to events like protests, rallies, and teach-outs, thanks to nearly $500,000 in dough from small-dollar donors. I like to think of Pizza to the Polls as a sort of last-ditch effort to do something good for another community, says Harlow. When you're sitting at home watching news reports of long lines in Illinois or Texas and wondering, how can I help from 3,000 miles away? That's where we come in. After the COVID-19 pandemic forced Pizza to the Polls to temporarily pause its operations during the primary elections, the grassroots organization is back with new safety measures and bigger than ever. Earlier this month, the group announced that in addition to its on-demand delivery services, it would also deploy a fleet of over 185 food trucks to 25 cities across the country, including Houston, Raleigh, Tampa, Detroit, Milwaukee, Louisville, and Los Angeles. The new food truck program is a response to record voting interest amid a pandemic causing many in-person voting locations to see longer wait times, Pizza to the Polls said in a statement. Poll worker shortages may limit the number of polling places, and social distancing measures are extending lines and limiting the number of people who can vote at one time. That scenario seems to be playing out nationwide. In Georgia, early voters at some polling places waited in line for up to 8 hours. Over the weekend, New Yorkers waited up to 4 hours to cast their ballot. In Texas, people stood in lines that snaked through parking lots and around voting locations for over 3 hours. And in Ohio, lines stretched for over a quarter of a mile when early voting kicked off earlier this month. But don't worry, in many states, early voters reported the process taking 5 minutes max, so don't let this deter you. Luckily, though, if hiccups, headaches, and hunger pangs arise, Pizza to the Polls is ready to fuel democracy, one slice at a time. This next article is called "The Secret to Mayor Pete Buttigieg and His Husband Chasten's Enduring Love." It was once a challenge to keep track of the dozens of candidates running for president in 2020. One undeniable standout in the crowded field was Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who went from dark horse to potential frontrunner before he ultimately left the race on March 1st. Now he endorses former Vice President Joe Biden. Buttigieg would have been the first openly gay president, which would have made his husband, Chasten Buttigieg, America's inaugural first gentleman. While cheering Pete on throughout his campaign, Chasten amassed a devoted following of his own, one that stands nearly 500,000 Twitter followers strong. Mashable called him the Twitter celebrity we deserve. Supportive and adept at navigating the digital age, Politico said he was winning the 2020 spouse primary. Before Pete ended his presidential campaign in March, Chastain gave a speech that captured their devoted bond, one that intertwines the personal and the political. About a year and a half ago, my husband came home from work and told me, well, he asked me, "What do you think about me running for president?" And I laughed, not at him, but at life. Because life gave me some interesting experiences on my way to find Pete. After falling in love with Pete, Pete got me to believe in myself again. And I told Pete to run because I knew there were other kids sitting out there in this country who needed to believe in themselves too, Chastain said. The couple, who were married in 2018, have an incredibly sweet and supportive relationship, which has won them, and their dogs, a devoted following. Below, a few key facts to know about Chastain, who, as the author of the memoir, I Have Something to Tell You, is a public figure in his own right. Chastain Glessman, that's his given name, grew up in a working-class family in Michigan. He told the Washington Post that he often felt like a misfit alongside his brothers, who were into playing sports and hunting. I would be inside reading Harry Potter or singing Celine Dion at the top of my lungs while my mom and I were dusting the cabinets, he said. His family's reaction to his coming out at the age of 18 was not positive. I don't recall my parents specifically saying I couldn't live at home anymore, but I was made to believe I needed to leave, he told the New York Times. Leaving home was the beginning of a tough period, in which Chastain sometimes slept on friends' couches, and sometimes slept in his car in the parking lot of his community college. Eventually, his mother called and asked, "Will you come home?" Chastain recalled to the Washington Post, "And I cried and I went home immediately." Though his relationship with his parents improved over time, they proudly walked him down the aisle when he married Pete. But he does remain estranged from his brothers. 11 years ago when I came out, I didn't think there was a place for me in this world, he recalled in a tweet in May, as he shared he and Pete's Time cover story. 10 months ago, I said I do. 1 month ago, we said, let's do this. A truly relatable modern couple, Pete and Chastain met in the summer of 2015 on Hinge, the app which seems to be rapidly eclipsing Tinder in terms of popularity. At the time, the two were living in different states, but per the Post, Chastain offered to visit Pete in South Bend. Their first meeting sounds like something right out of a romantic comedy. When Chastain got out of his car in front of Pete's house, they both said, "Howdy," at the same time. "So gross," Chastain remarked to the Post, but my heart fluttered. Their first date carried on in similar rom-com fashion. They bonded over scotch eggs, as you do, then watched a baseball game which featured fireworks. "Literally, there were fireworks on our first date," Chastain told the Times. "It was kind of ridiculous, I know, but I was hooked." Pete proposed in an unorthodox location. Nothing says romance quite like Chicago's O'Hare Airport, but there's a story behind Pete's decision to propose at O'Hare, according to the couple's Time profile. It was in that airport that Chastain first saw Pete's dating profile on Hinge. The couple were married at the Episcopal Cathedral of St. James in South Bend in June of 2018. And if their New York Times wedding announcement is anything to go by, the wedding was incredible. Tacos from the Rico Suave food truck, sliders from South Bend's The Beard and the Boss, even the pork was local, provided by Gunthrop Farms, a fourth-generation Indiana operation, beer from South Bend Brew Works, an assortment of regional cheeses from Oh Mama's Deli, salads from Café Navarre, lattes and coffees from Zen Café, housed inside Lang Lab, artisanal chocolates from local Violet Sky Chocolatier, specially created ice cream from the Outside Scoop, flavored with honey, harvested from community gardens, or whiskey from an Indiana distillery. Yes, hi, hello. Is there a way for us to go back in time and crash this wedding, please? Chastain Buttigieg is a dog lover. One of the many, many, many things we miss about the Obama era is the semi-regular updates from their adorable dogs, Sunny and Beau. Chastain and Pete are dog parents, too. Their pups are named Truman and Buddy Buttigieg. The couple adopted Truman, a Beagle Labrador mix, and Buddy, a one-eyed Beagle Pug mix, joined their household last year. Truman and Buddy have a sizable social media following of their own. Their own Twitter account currently has a following of more than 90,000, which is no surprise because every single update is a joy. Chasten is a ray of sunshine on social media. If you generally find Twitter to be a bottomless pit of despair and rage that leaves you feeling much worse every time you go on, A, you're not wrong, and B, you need to follow Chasten ASAP. His social feeds are relentlessly positive, even when he's touching on serious subject matter, and his Twitter generally features a mix of fun updates, premium dog content, and mindfulness tips. R. Eric Thomas really summed it up over at L when he wrote, quite literally, if the relentlessly upbeat potential first spouse ever took a social media break, I think I would spiral into a pit of despair that only a glint of light from Michelle Obama's Balenciaga boots could pull me out of. You owe it to yourself to make Chasten's updates a staple of your social media diet. He's incredibly supportive of his husband. Chasten used to be a junior high school teacher at the Montessori Academy in Mishawaka, Indiana, having earned his master's in education at the nearby DePaul University. But after Pete announced he was running for president, Chasten left his job to support him full-time, and now alternates between joining Pete on the road and taking care of things at home. Though he was incredibly supportive, Chasten has admitted that he wasn't sure how to react when Pete first announced his plans. I laughed, he told the Post. I was like, no. Are you serious? Okay, what are we thinking here? I love you. I believe in you. You're amazing. Do you think this would work? The couple celebrated their first wedding anniversary in 2019. 1 year ago, I married the love of my life, Pete wrote in an emotional June 16th, 2019 Twitter update, as he marked his one-year anniversary with Chasten. I'm so thankful I found you, Chasten, and I can't wait to spend the rest of our life together. Meanwhile, Chasten posted some adorable couple pictures and revealed that he was en route to find his cute guy on the trail. Can't believe it's been 1 year. We know it's used all the time, but these two really are relationship goals. Chasten's memoir, I Have Something to Tell You, was published in 2020. Chances are you're part of the Chasten fan club. Either you already were, or this article convinced you. In his recently published memoir, I Have Something to Tell You, you'll find the Chasten Buttigieg origin story in his own words. Earlier this year, OprahMag.com was lucky enough to publish an excerpt from the memoir about a particularly thrilling moment in Chasten and Pete's dating history. Pete, then a rising political star, invited Chasten to the White House's annual Christmas party, where he met none other than President Obama and the former First Lady. Clearly, the refreshingly candid, funny memoir offers a one-of-a-kind perspective on Washington, D.C. But the memoir also explores his life before Pete, not all of it easy. In the book, Chasten publicly discloses incidents of domestic violence in a past relationship and of sexual assault. I wanted to write my real story, and some of that was being really honest about what I thought, what I went through, what I experienced and navigated, and some of it was heartbreaking, Chasten told USA Today. Just as he cheers on Mayor Pete, we're cheering for Chasten for this brave, honest memoir, and whatever he does next. This next article is called My Friend Was a Con Artist, and He Was Conning Me. My best friend, Paul Erickson, turned out to be a notorious con artist, and I learned the hard way. He took millions from his victims. I'm one of them. I can overlook a lot of flaws if a person can make me laugh. When I first met Paul Erickson in 2009, I had no idea I would one day learn he was a Republican operative with an alleged Russian spy girlfriend, or that in 2020, he would be sentenced to 7 years in prison for defrauding investors. Back then, I was too busy noticing the most important thing. He made me laugh. Of course, when we met, I thought he was just another successful alum. In May 2009, the festivities for our 25th Yale class reunion were underway. Meeting Paul seemed like a happy accident. He was seated next to me at the morning class at Lindsay Chit, my favorite lecture hall. Ironically, the subject of the lecture was reinvention of the self. Little did I know, I was sitting beside a master of illusion, a man who made and remade his own identity from a think tank conservative to a racy storyteller, depending on who he was speaking to. And as much as it pains me to say it, I guess he became exactly what I needed, a friend. He was funny and quick, whispering an incessant stream of commentary to me and only me. It was that familiar, fast, us-against-the-world feeling, only achieved when sitting next to a kindred spirit in a chair with a desk attached. As a teacher for decades, I'd gotten used to being on the other side of the classroom. Whispering with a new friend during a lecture was a thrill. Unlike the rest of my classmates who were slyly referencing their own accomplishments and multi-million-dollar salaries, Paul did not ask me what I did. He seemed to care more about who I was, beyond the identities I'd carried with me in all of my introductions. A mother of two, a teacher, a wife of two decades. My life back then had a very tight routine. Waking my daughters up, getting them to school, then myself to school to teach. Days filled with responsibilities, chores, errands, activities, busy years. The house smelled of glue sticks. I suppose I was content with my life, with motherhood, with teaching, with my long marriage. But I had been swallowed up by the demands. So when I found myself back on Yale's old campus that weekend, this time as a 47-year-old, I was overwhelmed by the familiar yearning to be part of the college's community. The oversized tent, filled with accomplished classmates, brought me back to my younger self, the public school-educated girl from New Jersey with roots in Puerto Rico, instead of the Mayflower. But Paul, with his 6'4 stature, Midwestern upbringing, and bevy of close college friends, seemed to fit in with everyone, and effortlessly pulled me on to the inside of the tent where everyone else partied. For a change, it felt like they wanted to spend time with me. The night we met, Paul and I merged our friend groups and spent the evening laughing. When my husband and daughters arrived at the reunion the next day, they found me smiling. Paul quickly cultivated inside jokes with both of my daughters. Even my husband Nick, always wary and rarely swayed by glamour, seemed to tolerate him. But it was still Nick who raised the first red flag. After the rollicking final reunion dinner, in which Paul held court with stories of fighting communists during college summers and other outlandish adventures from his life straddling commerce, politics, and shadow organizations, my husband stayed up late on Google. "Are you sure he exists?" Nick asked me. "Are you sure he went to Yale?" This was 2009, and Paul was invisible on Google. A decade later, he would have a Wikipedia page. We joked that he was in the CIA, our friend, the spy. The truth was, he gave nothing away about his life, so he really could have been anything. An eccentric millionaire or a political operative. He was teeming with celebrity gossip that entranced my daughters. Maybe he was a well-connected columnist. By the time the reunion ended, I felt like I knew one thing that he was, a friend. And for a long, long time, I believed that he was one of my best friends. That was my first mistake. After the thrill of the reunion weekend had subsided, Paul immediately reached out to stay in touch, angling himself toward his ultimate position as an honorary member of my family. In the handwritten letters and long-winded emails addressed to Lady Lisa he sent after the event, Paul made me feel special and smart, worthy of such attention, even if my orbit stretched only the same town in which I was raised, not Washington, D.C., like some of his other friends. He spoke with the pace of Robin Williams and radiated charm, like a firework in a jar. It would be a crime, I thought, to look away, or to say no to his presents, which were foisted upon us in the months after the reunion, and did not seize until, well, until his arrest in 2019, more or less. Our first post-reunion gathering was at Sardi's, a famous midtown Manhattan restaurant often visited by Broadway stars. From there, our years were marked by events he planned just to brighten our lives, like that dinner. Impromptu trips to high school basketball games where he cheered on my daughter, even when she was benched. Tickets to Bruce Springsteen's Broadway show, and a play for my daughter's 16th birthday, with a pickup by Stretch Limo. There was also a surprise appearance at my older daughter's graduation party wearing a toga, a nod to my husband's Greek heritage. And then there was the trip to Orlando in 2015, where we swam with dolphins and went on rides and met his girlfriend, Maria Butina, a striking redhead who regaled us with stories about her childhood in Siberia. Maria, just a few years older than my daughters, would eventually tell me I was like a second mother to her. The gifts went in two directions. To commemorate our Florida getaway, I sent him a blanket with a blow-up photo, all six of us petting dolphins and smiling. He responded in an email, "No one ever gives me birthday presents anymore, except you," with 3 exclamation marks. Consistently, for his birthday and on Christmas, I sent packages to his South Dakota home filled with presents that would delight a kid, toys from his favorite cartoons, an assortment of every kind of M&M. You are one, if not the leading, source of unmitigated joy in my life. There is never a conversation, a meal, or an adventure with you that doesn't leave me a better man, he emailed me one Christmas. I certainly could not match his gifts in terms of extravagance, but I gave him another kind of gift, which some might call priceless. Time spent with people who cared about him. Sometimes, I think of all of us sitting on my patio, telling stories and laughing, and I see it through a panoramic lens. Maybe that fun was real for him. It's possible that ultimately my gift to Paul was more than the money I would eventually give him. In 2014, 5 years after I met Paul, we gathered again for our 30th reunion. When I was unable to secure a hotel room, Paul heroically offered my husband and me his luxurious accommodations. As I recall, he even paid the bill. He was especially generous that weekend, covering the tab when a large group of classmates gathered for pizza and beer at one of our favorite New Haven joints the first night of the reunion. We were all shocked by his generosity. Cheeks flushed, feeling full and thankful, we let him pay. He was generous because he wasn't spending his own money. In fact, by that time, he was probably spending mine. At some point between the reunions and the outings and the vacations, a whole bunch of us had gathered at the Yale Club to celebrate our 50th birthdays in 2012. That was when Paul set his trap, and I walked into it with a big, dumb smile on my face, the one I reserved for my friends. He knew I was the type to invest in the dignity chair, a device that made it possible for people with limited mobility to use the bathroom by themselves. He said we would get a return on our investment. He said the money could help pay for my daughter's college educations. My husband and I invested in this scam, which I later learned from the FBI agent was a legitimate patent, just not one belonging to Paul. But there were other pitches, too, for other people. A venture to develop land in the oil fields of North Dakota, near where he was raised in South Dakota, by adoptive parents, for example. That scam he used on the governors and congressmen and all the other important people he spent most of the year with, when he wasn't doing things like dropping by our patio for a nice tea and a laugh with his New Jersey family. In addition to elaborate gifts, his currency was in shadowy pronouncements that later would be proven true, cementing his status as my household's Nostradamus, an emissary from the land of powerful people who knew things. After years of political tidbits in 2016, while at my daughter's graduation party, he pronounced that Donald Trump would be president. That one came true, of course. With our friendship, I convinced myself that pure fun could be a bridge over political differences. He proved to me, a lifelong liberal and an idealist at heart, that some relationships really could surmount divides. I congratulated myself for my open-mindedness. Now, I'm less of an idealist. I realized that Paul sized me up so quickly. I was a middle-aged woman in need of some attention, an easy mark. After his arrest in February 2019, we learned some specifics of Paul's history, but certainly not all of them. He transferred to Yale from the University of South Dakota and went on to the University of Virginia Law School. He had long-standing ties to the NRA. He produced a Hollywood film, Red Scorpion, starring Dolph Lundgren. He worked on several Republican campaigns, including Pat Buchanan's presidential bid in 1992. In 1997, he organized a Christian rally that brought 1.2 million men to Washington, D.C., pledging to uphold spiritual values. Recently, Paul's time cavorting with a conservative and Christian elite brought him to a 3-year stint on the board of the American Conservative Union. He also served as an informal advisor to Mitt Romney. According to his sentencing proceedings, Paul allegedly took $5.3 million from approximately 78 investors, In a 22-year-long scheme stretching back to 1997, in the end, all that worrying about our status in his social circle was for naught. We were as important as everyone else, important enough to be conned. This isn't to say that I didn't know better. I did. Beyond his stories were puppet strings, and I attached myself to them. Other people, when they looked at Paul, saw what he really was. A tall man sporting garish, lumpy polos and a Ronald McDonald haircut. But other people did not have Paul's light shining on them. When that's in your eyes, it's all you can see. The last time I saw Paul and Maria was at a gathering he planned at an elegant restaurant on Manhattan's East Side in March of 2017. He invited my daughter to meet the famed journalist Gay Talese, ostensibly to help her writing career. I later learned Paul's relationship with a journalist dated back to 1993, when Paul was serving as John Wayne Bobbitt's media advisor and Talese was covering the scandal. Before the night ended, Mr. Talese pulled me aside to tell me that Paul was not a nice man and that I should be careful. But by then, it was too late. In July of 2018, Maria, Paul's girlfriend, and my Russian daughter, in quotation marks, was arrested and charged with acting as an agent for the Russian Federation. Maria was allegedly trying to influence Republican officials on behalf of the Russian government. When the news broke, a classmate and I connected over our shared relationship with Paul. By February of the following year, Paul was indicted on charges unrelated to Maria's headline-making case. Instead, he was found at the center of a two-decades-long scheme to defraud investors. My friend and I were just two among many. She gave me the phone number of an agent at the FBI and assured me that I would feel better after I made the call. I spoke to the FBI agent in South Dakota, where Paul grew up, and later cultivated his cons for over an hour. He was remarkably kind and supportive. He told me what distinguished Paul from the dozens of criminals and con men he'd encountered over the years was that he remained a good friend to his victims throughout it all. After giving his friends, in quotation marks, phony financial statements, even while siphoning off his friends' money to fund his adventures, even while doing all of that, he continued the charade of friendship. He didn't run away out of shame. The agent told me that he had been dealing with con men for most of his long career, and that Paul was one of the best, which of course meant that he was one of the worst. The months following my conversation with the agent were bleak. My husband was out of work. I was dealing with health issues that were probably related to all of the stress. I felt empty, sort of like when the carnival leaves town. The memories of fun were coupled with the realization that the fun was all a facade. As much as the loss of the money, what hurt was the idea that all of that, all of those memories we shared, weren't real. We had wasted our time and our energy. But I kept going. I kept listening to music where the lyrics outweighed the melody, kept watering my orchids, kept reading poetry and writing my own. The orchids continuing to blossom gave me the little miracles I needed to make it to tomorrow. My husband and daughters and friends' love gave me the support to stay upright when I got there. By May 2019, I was almost ready to return to Yale for my 35th reunion, but still wobbly, to use a term from a former roommate. Before the reunion, we all received an invitation to participate on a panel with a theme of curveballs. I summoned the courage to volunteer and joined other classmates who had dealt with a variety of challenging obstacles. The sun was streaming through the stained glass windows when I walked to the podium and told my story. That Paul, the supposed friend I had met 10 years prior in that very room, had betrayed me, conned me out of money, and had almost broken me. But he hadn't. I was still standing. Speaking the truth was liberating and empowering, and the kindness I received afterward from classmates was an unexpected reward. The experience reminded me of the Japanese pottery that's prized for the cracks which are highlighted with gold instead of being hidden. I felt like one of those bowls, cracked but stronger. I thought of this image when I attended one of Oprah's 2020 Vision Tour stops with my daughter in January 2020. Elena, culture editor for this website, oprahmag.com, was covering the event in Atlanta, and she brought me along as her guest. In that stadium in Atlanta, Oprah spoke about the importance of intention. It was then that I realized that my intention was to tell my story in order to heal myself, yes, but also to warn others to protect themselves. If someone only shows you one side of himself, that means he's hiding the other sides. Sometimes I wonder whether my appeal for Paul was more than just that I was an easy mark, honest and vulnerable. Maybe he really did like us as much as he showed he did, in flowery letters and gusts of laughter. Maybe he hoped that spending time with people who were whole would make him less broken. Or maybe it was a lie all along, though that is the one maybe I have yet to fully accept. In November of 2019, Paul pleaded guilty to one charge of wire fraud and one charge of money laundering, both felonies. On July 6, 2020, I watched as District Judge Karen E. Schreier sentenced Paul to 7 years in federal prison. "You're a thief, and you have betrayed your friends and family, pretty much everyone you know," Schreier said. I had a bottle of champagne chilling for a long time, waiting for Paul's sentencing. But along with that milestone, I celebrated my own survival. I thought of the poet Lucille Clifton and her words, "Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed." I thought of Oprah and one of her mantras, "I can. I will. Watch me." Before I handed over the letters Paul wrote me to the FBI, I read them again and forgave myself a little. When I get the opportunity to steal a few hours with someone like you, a source of radiating joy, my work life dissipates. You give your husband, your children, and your friends the most truly precious gift in life, unconditional love from a pure heart. I count myself blessed to share a morsel of that, Paul wrote in January 2012, around the same time I wrote him the check. In the end, Paul did give me what I needed. Paul had always encouraged my desire to be a writer, and he gave me a story that I had to tell. Now I know that I didn't need him to accomplish it. Lately I've been writing a memoir about my 50s, entitled Spies, Con Men, and Other Indignities of Middle Age. I finally got the gift I most desired, the story that I had to write, the story that made me a writer. This next article is called Brad Pitt Gave Joe Biden the Most American Presidential Endorsement Possible, during the World Series, no less. Is there anything more prototypically American than a legendary American film star endorsing a presidential candidate during a baseball game? During Saturday night's World Series game, baseball-loving Americans heard Brad Pitt's dulcet tones wash over a campaign ad for Joe Biden, marking Pitt's first official foray into the 2020 election. Pitt hailed Biden as the choice to represent all Americans, delivering an impassioned monologue about Biden's ability to unite a fractured nation. In the one-minute television spot, featuring footage of the Democratic candidate meeting, embracing, and laughing with Americans of varying ages and identities, Pitt speaks about Biden's gift of empathy, as well as his power to unify Americans from all political backgrounds. His narration reads in full. "America is a place for everyone. Those who chose this country, those who fought for it, some Republicans, some Democrats, and most, just somewhere in between, all looking for the same thing, someone who understands their hopes, their dreams, their pain, to listen, to bring people together, to get up every day and work and to make life better for families like yours, to look you in the eye, treat you with respect, and tell you the truth, to work just as hard for the people who voted for him as those who didn't, to be a president for all Americans." Pitt's advocacy for Biden should come as no surprise to anyone following his trajectory of political activism. Though Pitt seems to choose his forays into politics judiciously, his word always carries heavy weight, as when he condemned Senate Republicans at the 2020 Oscars for stymieing testimony from John Bolton. "They told me I only had 45 seconds up here, which is 45 seconds more than the Senate gave John Bolton this week," Pitt riffed during his acceptance speech for the Best Supporting Actor. Pitt also appeared as Dr. Anthony Fauci on SNL, poking fun at the Trump administration's response to the coronavirus pandemic. Pitt's ad, titled Make Life Better, is the latest installment in an ongoing series of ads that the Biden campaign has aired during some of the priciest airtime on television. Each narrated by actors, including Pitt and Sam Elliott, the ads have aired during 5 NFL games as well as each World Series game, with one World Series ad reportedly costing the Biden campaign $4 million. Seems there's truly no better time for Pitt and Biden to make their case to Americans than during that most American of pastimes, beached out on the couch, taking in a sports game, inhaling a bag of Cheetos. All right, this next article is called Prince William and Kate Middleton are looking for a live-in housekeeper. Fancy breaking your lease, quitting your job, and relocating to a literal royal palace? If you're adept at maintaining a very large house, you'll probably never get a better opportunity than this. Prince William and Kate Middleton are hiring a housekeeper for their Kensington Palace home, and you've got under 2 weeks to apply. One small snag. The job listing stresses confidentiality and discretion as key components of the role, suggesting the hiring committee might not react favorably to Cambridge superfans hoping to live out their royal fantasies and document the whole affair on Instagram. Still, it's worth a shot. According to the job listing, the successful applicant will support the management of all housekeeping operations. Candidates should have an organized approach and take pride in what they do, while they should also be able to manage a varied workload, show initiative, and be content to work flexibly, including being able to travel. And here's the crucial part. Maintaining confidentiality and exercising discretion at all times is paramount. The salary for the role starts at £19,140, which is just under $25,000, according to the Mirror. Plus, there's one enormous perk. The housekeeper will be given the opportunity to live at Kensington Palace, with meals and travel expenses covered. Applications close on November 7th, so if you're hoping to be roomies with Kate Middleton, you'd better start working on that resume. And sticking with the royal theme, here's an article called Prince Harry Says Living in Meghan Markle's Shoes Made Him Truly Aware of Unconscious Bias. Prince Harry and Meghan have already made it clear that campaigning for racial justice will be a key part of their work moving forward. And now the prince has shared some of his most personal reflections on racism in a discussion with Black Lives Matter activist and protest hero Patrick Hutchinson. The Duke of Sussex took part in an online chat with Patrick as part of British GQ's content for Black History Month and for their Heroes series, in which they recognize the best of Britain. They discussed the Black Lives Matter movement, fatherhood, mental health, and more for almost 40 minutes. Harry described how ignorance is no longer an excuse for unconscious bias, but reflected that it took him many years to realize what it was. He said it was living a day or a week in my wife's shoes that made him especially aware of the issue. Unconscious bias, from my understanding, you know, having had the upbringing and the education that I had no idea what it was. I had no idea it existed, said the prince. And then, sad as it is to say, it took me many, many years to realize it, especially then living a day or a week in my wife's shoes. Patrick rose to global fame in June during a Black Lives Matter protest in London when he lifted a white counter-protester to safety. He was described as a hero for his actions. Today, Prince Harry called him a guardian angel and is now using his platform to advocate for racial justice and a fairer society. He and three friends have since set up a new collective, United to Change and Inspire, and he's writing a book. During his conversation with Prince Harry, Patrick also reflected on unconscious bias. I feel like, first of all, you have to be willing to listen and have the conversation and have those uncomfortable conversations. It is an uncomfortable conversation, and I totally get it, especially for a white person who wants to be told that they may potentially have a little bit of racism in them, he said. He continued, there's a big class thing in here too, and it's a combination of the two because it's not only black people who are struggling or non-white people. There are white people who are struggling in impoverished areas, along with black people who don't get the opportunities and the chances that others might get. Harry listened as Patrick, who is a father of four, shared how his 11-year-old is becoming very aware of and notices racism. He said, my nickname for her, I call her Pretty Girl, because I know her skin is so dark to some people, and that may not be as beautiful to them as it is to me. So I call her Pretty Girl to help empower her and let her know that she's beautiful and that she can do whatever she wants in life. Because I know that when she gets out there, there is a chance that that might hold her back through no fault of her own. Describing how it's going to take every single one of us to really change things, Harry continued, saying that anyone that's pushing against it really needs to take a long, hard look at themselves in the mirror. Because I said, this isn't black versus white. As you quite rightly pointed out, now in 2020, we have protesters of every color, every background, every religion, every belief, every age. This is a global movement. And the train has left the station, and if you're not on it now, then get on it, because there is so much that we can do. Being a dad myself, the whole point in life, I guess, for me, is to try and leave the world in a better place than when you found it. The prince also spoke of the responsibilities on people and institutions with power to examine whether they're playing a role in perpetuating bias, saying, I think one of the most dangerous things is people within positions of power, whether it's politics or whether it's the media, where if you're not aware of your own bias and you're not aware of the culture within your system, then how are we ever going to progress? How are we ever going to get to that point where there is more fairness? He added, because it's not a zero-sum game, right? Everyone benefits if the black community are treated the way that they should be treated. It is a learning process. It's actually not up for debate. These are the facts. This is what's happening. Additionally, the two men spoke about the apprehension some white people feel in starting a conversation about race. People need to not be afraid. I think that can be part of it for some white people. I think they can be afraid. They're scared of saying the wrong thing, possibly, Patrick said. Harry agreed. Oh, that's a huge part of it. Not everyone is going to get it right, and from what I've seen, people are desperately trying to get it right, and even when trying to get it right, they massively get it wrong, he said. But the prince continued, these are conversations that need to be had across all corners of society and all platforms of power as well, because that's where the difference is going to be made. And they both acknowledged that there is still much work to do. Speaking about the fact that the protests were needed, Patrick says, it makes you wonder why people find it so hard to understand what we're all striving for. The equality side of things, it really brings home how much work we have to do. Harry agreed, but said, I genuinely feel as though the world is very much heading in the right direction. But inevitably, a lot of the pain has to come to the surface before we can actually turn the page and start the new chapter. The conversation ended with the two men wishing each other's families well, with Harry saying he and Meghan were working our asses off, and Archie's keeping us very busy, but he's making us laugh every day, which is great. And now I'm going to read an article called Jennifer Lawrence Said She Was a Republican Before Donald Trump Was Elected. Jennifer Lawrence said she used to be a little Republican, revealing she voted for John McCain over Barack Obama in the 2008 presidential elections during a recent appearance on the podcast Absolutely Not. Lawrence said that she previously aligned with the Republican Party on fiscal matters, but disagreed on social issues, before stating that the election of Donald Trump changed everything regarding her association with the party. It's extremely hard to talk about politics. You don't want to. I'm an actor. I want everyone to see my movies, Lawrence told host Heather McCann. I grew up Republican. The first president, my first time voting, I voted for John McCain. I was a little Republican. I was fortunate to grow up in a Republican house where I could see the fiscal benefits of some of the Republican policies, and I could also see that the social issues weren't in line with my views, Lawrence continued. But then for me, when Donald Trump got elected, that just changed everything. This is an impeached president who's broken many laws and has refused to condemn white supremacy, and it feels like there's a line drawn in the sand, and I don't give a F word. I guess that's the bottom line. As The Independent reports, Lawrence previously spoke about her changing political beliefs. I'm grateful in a weird way that I have the Republican perspective. Growing up in a house of Republicans and hearing why we should vote Republican, for tax reasons, for religious reasons, she said. And then, you know, you grow up and you start becoming a citizen of the world, and my personal beliefs started to change. I thought, well, I guess it is fair for me to pay taxes because that's kind of like paying rent to live in this amazing country. And I like things like hospitals and schools, and it makes sense for me to play my part as a citizen to make this country as great as it can be. This next article is called Pope Francis Supports Civil Union Laws for Same-Sex Couples. They are children of God, he said in a new documentary. Homosexual people have a right to be in a family, he said in the film Francesco, which premiered on Wednesday, October 1st at the Rome Film Festival. You can't kick someone out of a family nor make their life miserable for this. What we have to have is a civil union law. That way they are legally covered. Since his time as pontiff began in 2013, the Pope has taken progressive stances on a number of controversial issues, from climate change to racism and George Floyd's murder. However, it is important to point out that civil unions are not the same as marriage. Civil unions only give legal protections to couples on a state level, while marriages are largely nationally recognized and provide federal protections and benefits. In 2015, the Pope himself said that same-sex marriage threatened traditional families, but in 2019, he stated that gay tendencies are not a sin. However, his current stance is monumental for the leader of a Christian institution that has historically been intolerant of the LGBTQ community, often sending mixed signals in regards to their support or lack thereof. Though priests across the world take their own stances when it comes to acceptance of queer people in relationships, official church teachings label the community as partaking in grave depravity and state that homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered. God loves your children as they are, Pope Francis told a group of parents of LGBTQ youth in September. The church loves your children as they are because they are children of God. The documentary Francesco tells the life story of Pope Francis and premieres in the U.S. at the Savannah Film Festival on October 25th. This next article is called This Woman is Working to End Food Apartheid in South Los Angeles. If you give Olympia Ossett a crate of cauliflower, she is going to feed a community. How far away is your local grocery store? A 10-minute walk? A 15-minute drive if the lights are green? 4 years ago, Olympia Ossett was regularly spending 2.5 hours on a city bus to stock up on kale, carrots, tomatoes, cashews, and the like. And not because she's some kind of foodie diva. All she wanted was decent nutrition, which in her hometown of South Los Angeles is remarkably hard to come by. A mere 91 grocery stores serve the area's approximately 820,000 residents, most of whom are Latinx or Black. Liquor stores, 119, drastically outnumber farmers markets. There are only 5. Ossett, 29, had a food awakening 11 years ago when she went vegan during her freshman year at Howard University. Upon moving back home in 2012, she quickly realized that her personal struggle to find fresh produce nearby was community-wide. South LA qualifies as a food desert, an area in which access to fruits and vegetables is limited or punishingly far away. But deserts occur naturally, says Ossett, who prefers to say food apartheid. That term brings attention to the fact that this issue is man-made, the result of oppression. It is not an accident. In 2016, fed up with the local scarcity, Ossett launched Supermarket, a combination pop-up stand, though that's on hiatus since COVID struck, and grocery service. On weekdays, she and a crew of volunteers pick up yams, oranges, beets, and other healthy foods from farmers and organic wholesalers. The bounty is then organized order by order and left on about 100 doorsteps every weekend. To date, Supermarket has distributed 70,000 pounds of low-cost groceries. It held an emergency 1,400-pound grain and seed giveaway when the pandemic hit. Though she's careful to include familiar produce, bananas and mangoes don't grow locally, but our customers regularly use them. Ossett strives to introduce lesser-known ingredients, too. Education is a big part of the mission, she says. Someone once texted me a picture of fresh basil and asked, "What is this?" So I sent him a pesto recipe. He made it and texted back, "Oh my God, this is so good." Next, I'm going to read an excerpt of Cast by Isabel Wilkerson. This is Oprah's latest book club pick. She says it's her most important book club pick ever. In this excerpt, four anthropologists, two couples, one white and the other black, who descend on a town in Mississippi to conduct a groundbreaking experiment in interracial scholarship, which would involve them infiltrating the white and black worlds to accurately render how caste, class, and race operated in the region. Because two of the four researchers were black, their studies were hampered by the very system they sought to expose, and their report fell, perhaps unsurprisingly, into the margins of history. On the front lines of caste. In the fall of 1933, a distinguished black couple, newly returned from their studies in Europe, headed south from Virginia in the direction of Nashville, and then, with both dread and anticipation, passed a symbolic iron curtain into the heart of Jim Crow, Mississippi. They were anthropologists, embarking on a perilous 2-year study of the social hierarchy of the South. They were entering hostile and alien territory where they would have to learn to sublimate their upright bearing and submit to the humiliations of the social order, knowing that any slip-up could cost them their lives. They could not reveal the true nature of their mission at their final destination of Mississippi. They would have to watch their every step in a world that preferred to keep its feudal conventions to itself and to keep people who looked like them in their place. They were driving headlong into a region where a black person was lynched every 4 days for some breach, large or small, of those conventions. They would soon discover that just weeks before their arrival, a black man had been lynched in the county next to Natchez under accusation of raping a white woman that even many local whites did not believe. Allison Davis was an impeccably tailored academic with a sculpted, square-jawed face of a film star, and his wife, Elizabeth, was a model of refinement. But their path had been a twisting obstacle course. Just the previous spring, they had cut short their advanced studies at the University of Berlin and fled Germany when Hitler took power. They had seen the Nazis burn books and jail teachers, and this gave him new insight into the nature of hate, and combined with the burdens he bore in his own country, further inspired him to examine injustice. Davis was a young anthropologist with 2 degrees from Harvard University and a wealth of experience abroad. But once in Mississippi, he could not in any way act like it. He would have to conceal his inner self to survive. The couple had chosen to make the personal sacrifice for the greater good of documenting the structure of human division, a mission that would practically render them undercover agents. Urbane and bespectacled though he was, he decided it was best to keep a gun in the car to protect himself and his wife if it came to it. In Natchez, they would be joining the other half of their team, a white couple named Burley and Mary Gardner, two other Harvard anthropologists who, in keeping with the plan, had preceded the Davises to Mississippi. The mission was quietly revolutionary. Together, they would embed themselves in a closed and isolated southern town from both sides of the caste divide. Coming from the north, neither couple could fully know what they were getting themselves into. This was in the depths of the Jim Crow caste system, and they would find their every move dictated by the very phenomenon that they were studying. This would be among the first studies of its kind and a groundbreaking experiment in interracial scholarship. They would have to plan every detail of their interaction with the local people and come up with plausible reasons for the four of them to be together in this alien landscape. Given the dangers, they would not be able to tell the local people the full intention of their project, that they were seeking to infiltrate the white and black worlds to accurately render how caste, class, and race operated in the region. The two couples were to report back to a senior professor who was overseeing the project from Cambridge. Pioneering anthropologist W. Lloyd Warner anticipated the dangers the team would face and went to Natchez himself ahead of the two couples to scout out the area and to prepare the town for their arrival. Warner met with the mayor and law enforcement officials and with the editors of the local newspaper before leaving the team on his own. He told town officials that they had chosen Natchez to represent a typical southern town and that the researchers would be collecting data to compare it with a town in the north. This was not altogether untrue. Warner had completed research on social stratification in Newburyport, Massachusetts, and could find the comparison useful. The officials in Natchez were delighted to share the history of their town with the white husband and wife team. but it was harder for the team to come up with a credible reason for African-American scholars to come to town doing research. They made the decision to tell the locals that the black researchers were there to study the black church, a safe enough subject for the town fathers to accept. As a measure of how far ahead of society the researchers were, and of the proficiency of Allison Davis, it was he, the black anthropologist, who was chosen to lead the team on the ground in Natchez. They were two different castes, studying caste, in the belly of the caste system. In order for the mission to work, the white couple went in first to get established before the black couple showed up. The gardeners rented rooms in an old country mansion as their base of operations and began gaining acceptance in Natchez society. But they had to give more forethought into where the Davises would live. The mansion was isolated, and the Davises would be uncomfortably, perhaps dangerously, conspicuous in that rural setting. Finding housing for them was a challenge in a region where most African Americans were sharecroppers living in lean-to cabins. The team finally moved the project into town itself, and the Davises rented rooms from a black doctor who opened the way to the town's few black elites. The couple soon found themselves embedded in their respective and separate caste, but that restricted them in other ways. The team needed to study the layers within each caste, the elite and the lowly, but the social hierarchy drew such stark lines that even within one caste, fraternizing with those not seen as on one's own level invited scrutiny and potential ostracism. To reach poor white residents, the lower class of the dominant caste, Mary Gardner took a position as a government caseworker in a New Deal program, which allowed her to visit poorer whites and visit their homes. That was not an option available to Elizabeth Davis, as the Davises sought to meet with poorer black residents. At the time, few African-American women were permitted to hold those government jobs in Mississippi. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ann Jordan, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.